Hi, I'm Nick, on a mission for Morning Coffee in River North, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today, here on show number 921. And what we do here on this show is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. So good morning to Bob. And hey, it's a big show this week. We dive into a new report that looks at how Chicagoans consume their news and what they know about local media outlets. It's really interesting, so stick around for that. Also, when you were in school, you probably had to endure the school cafeteria. For a lot of us, that probably wasn't the best experience. However, there is now a law in Illinois that gives students more healthy lunch options at school, but students have to opt into it. We find out how this works, and we discover the secret history of 1970s and 80s Southern rockers from here in Chicago, the Pearl Handle Band. And I'll tell you what, their music absolutely shreds. Speaking of music, this weekend is the Chicago Blues Fest. It's the largest free blues fest in the world, and we should all go check it out. I love blues music. I love blues clubs. So sure, go to the Blues Fest this weekend, but then this weekend or whenever, check out a blues club. Now you might be thinking, wait, Mike, haven't a lot of blues clubs folded? Aren't blues clubs that are still around really touristy these days? Will it be an authentic experience? To all that, I say, yeah, we've lost some blues clubs, but what authentic experience are you looking for? I mean, the whole reason we're in the audience at these places is for the talent, the music, the show. If the music is good, then that's going a long way. That music is the result of a rich tradition, especially here in Chicago. And some of these blues clubs and blues bars are an authentic experience. If by authentic experience, we're talking about kind of a rundown place with a no-frills attitude, cold drinks, maybe off the beaten path a little bit, that's still a thing to a degree. For example, right before the pandemic in 2020, I visited a club on this show called The Waterhole at 1400 Southwestern. It's one of the best kept secrets in Chicago. I sat down with the owner of the bar, Howard Anthony, and here's what he had to say about The Waterhole.
Hey, it's Chicago Juke Joint, as it says. We have the restaurant in the back, music room here, and the front room is where we have little entertainment, not much.
There's some karaoke that happens, right?
Well, occasionally we have karaoke, live blues, Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday, live music.
That clip from Outside the Loop, number 696, available at OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and WGNRadio.com. Live music three nights a week. Awesome. And let me tell you, that place is an authentic experience, and it's still there. Will you see some tourists? Probably not at the Waterhole, but maybe in some other places you will, and really, so what? Let's share the music experience, especially at a time when the national narrative about Chicago isn't the greatest. So all you folks from St. Louis, Detroit, Sacramento, downstate, come on in. We'll show you a good time. Those who have listened to this show over the years know that one of my favorite topics to discuss, because I feel it is so darn important, is the state of local journalism. Local news, as we have traditionally known it, is struggling. However, many of us in Chicago don't know that. That's according to a new report that is out right now from Northwestern University's Medill Local News Initiative. They are online at localnewsinitiative.northwestern.edu, and Tim Franklin is the director of the Medill Local News Initiative at Northwestern, and he joins us here once again on Outside the Loop. Tim, nice to talk to you again.
Good to be with you again, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. So this report is, I have so many feelings, I guess. This report, it's saying a lot of things here. So let's not be all doom and gloom. Let's start with the positives here. And I think this is really something most of us, according to those folks who were surveyed here, most of us in Chicagoland are consumers of local news, 52% of adults. That seems like it's significant. I didn't think it would be that high.
Yeah, no, there is definitely good news in this report, Mike. First of all, let me just say that we surveyed more than 1,000 people in the 14-county Chicago region. The NORC at UChicago did the poll for us, and then we compiled it and put together this report along with some help. So, yes, the good news in here is that a majority of Chicagoans are consuming local news, and that's healthy, and it shows that there's strong demand for local news, and it also shows that a majority of Chicagoans trust local news sources in Chicago. And at a time when trust in the news media is running very low nationally, like down in the low 30%, depending on which survey you look at, the fact that people in Chicago are consuming news and that they trust what they're reading, I think it's highly significant and a good sign.
Right. You say that about, of those surveyed, 53% say that local news media gets things right. So there is this level of confidence and trust in local media here in our region that we just don't see nationally. So I would say that's a good thing. And you know, as we look at how this is being consumed, how news is being consumed, I mean, it's no surprise, I think, to anyone to find out that, well, it looks like digital is really where everything continues to head. And smartphones, really, there is a clear shift to smartphones. And that is, according to this survey, how we are getting our news. Really, newspapers, not great news for newspapers, they fall off pretty substantially on this list.
Yeah, Mike, let me just step back for a second and say that we are all truly living through a historic evolution in how people consume news and how news is produced and how it's distributed and how it's paid for. This is truly a tectonic change that's happening in news in America. And so we've all known that this was coming, and now it really feels like it's happening and even happened in some cases. So you're absolutely right. What we see is that smartphones have supplanted television as the device of choice in consuming local news. And I've been looking at these local news surveys for decades, mm-hmm. and this is the first time that I've ever seen smartphones surpass television as the primary device by which people get their local news. And I think that's hugely significant for a number of reasons. One is that, for news organizations, are you creating news tailored for the smartphone, for how people are actually consuming you? And then obviously, people who are consuming on smartphones aren't spending as much time as they might be watching television news or reading a newspaper or a digital site. So that has implications as well. And then we're also seeing that the primary source by which people are getting their local news are search engines. It's not local television news or radio or newspapers. So I think this is hugely significant. What this shows is that the digital consumption and delivery of local news is now the predominant way people are getting their news and information. And this has huge ripple effects for news organizations and for the business model of news organizations.
Yeah. So walk me through that, because when we say search engines, I mean, Google, obviously, that's the one I think that comes to the forefront of all of our brains. But is it people are going onto Google and they're searching, migrant crisis or Donald Trump conviction, and then they're just the results that pop up, they're just going after those. That's how they're getting the news?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, Mike, another aspect of what's happening right now is how quickly AI is being adopted by people. So consider this. So right now, you do a search on Google, and what comes up are some summaries of news stories and links that you can then click on to go get more news and information on whatever topic it is you're interested in. Mm-hmm. With AI and with these new tools that are being developed, it's an ask and answer equation. So you ask a question in a search engine, and then it just gives you the answer. It doesn't take you to a local news site. So one of the concerns with this AI revolution is that traffic to local news sites and then the ad revenue that goes with that traffic could really be affected by, you know, this change to the platform. And it really changes the whole kind of business equation of the internet, if you will. So, and then there are all the questions about whether AI is actually getting you factual information,
right,
in the first place. So that could really have a big impact.
And AI is pulling information, whether it's correct or not, but it's getting information from someplace, and those places online that maybe put out that information who are looking for revenue are saying, wait a second, are you going to pay me for, the AI scanning my site and taking this and developing it into an answer for someone? I think that's another layer of this too.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Mike. And I think we're headed toward the mother of all copyright lawsuits. The New York Times has already sued OpenAI and Microsoft. Alden, which owns the Chicago Tribune, has sued OpenAI and Microsoft. And so I think we're on the precipice of a huge legal battle. Oh, basically, and the question is, who owns information? I mean, that's really what this is all about.
Let's talk about some of the business aspects here. And you and I have done this in the past, but there's a section in this report. It's called Disconnect in Perspectives. And, you know, here I am. I'm saying democracy, and I do believe in democracy. I believe in the press. I believe in the role of the press, and it's vital, and we need the conversations. All that being said here, when you did this survey, the results, when you have you looked at people, the reasons why that they are consuming local news, and the top two, the first one is so news can help them save money or manage their money. And number two, it helps people stay healthy. And then if you look down that list, the connection to community and being a better citizen, that really doesn't have as much importance as the helping to save money and manage money for people and to stay healthy. Can you explain what is going on here? Do we even know?
Well, look, I mean, my whole career as a journalist, I've looked at this very altruistically, you know, that local journalism provides essential news and information that people need to be informed citizens and to participate in the civic life of their community. And I still believe that to be true. But I also think that this poll shows that people in their everyday lives are turning to local news in more of a transactional way. You know, what's on sale at the local grocery store this week? What's on sale at the local mall? They're looking at the utility of local news and not just the kind of civic or community value that local news provides. So, you know, I was not necessarily surprised by this result. I was surprised by the extent of the numbers, you know, that the numbers are so overwhelmingly tilted toward people looking to local news to save money and help them manage their lives. And I also think that there's a bit of a message for news organizations in this, in that, you know, they need to be thinking about how they can deliver news and information that helps people live their daily lives. Yes, it's what is the latest story out of City Hall, or, you know, what's happening with the Bears Stadium or with the school board. But there's more to it than that, you know, to be relevant to audiences.
Yeah. Another part of this survey, and this one, I don't know, this one sent me flying here, but you and I have talked about financial problems that traditional media are having. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the circles that we live in. I felt like, you know, people knew that. But according to this survey, 71% of those who are surveyed say that newspapers and other media are functioning in a healthy way, that there are no financial problems. We know that that just is not the case. There are big time financial issues with media platforms across the board here. I don't know, Tim. There's a question in there somewhere, but I think I'm still reeling from what I was reading from your report here on this one.
Yeah, to people like you and me that are close to this, it's a mind-blowing number. You know, how could people possibly not know that there are more news deserts than ever, that, you know, that Illinois has lost 85% of its newspaper journalists in the last 19 years. You know, it seems evident to us, but, you know, I thought a lot about the responses to this question. And so here's what I would posit. If you're just going along living your daily life and you're looking at news on your smartphone and you're getting news alerts and you know, your phone is blown up on social media with some local issues, then you may think, oh, okay, well, I got a lot of local information here, so everything must be fine. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you're missing. You know, in kind of this crush of just noise that is coming into your smartphone every day. And the reality is that, you know, we have lost a third of all local newspapers in the last 19 years, even more than that in Illinois, which is one of the hardest hit states in the country. And, you know, just a few days ago, the Illinois legislature approved tax credits to try to help local news organizations hire and retain journalists. They approved a journalism scholarship program for students who agree to work in local news outlets for a couple of years. I mean, policymakers in Illinois and across the country, I think, are becoming more aware of this problem and are now taking steps to do something about it. But yeah, if you're just going along, going to work, trying to feed your family and, you know, go to your kids' school events, it may not be apparent to you what the crisis is here.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think something that really ties into that, and this isn't surprising, is people don't want to pay for the news that they seem to be getting for free on their smartphones. So as we were talking about, you get alerts on your phone, you click on them, you read an article, you read a quick snippet of something, you maybe even watch a video on your phone or listen to something. And that's all free. And so people don't want to pay for this, according to the survey. And like you're saying here, well, Illinois legislature, tax credits, right? We're trying to provide some creative funding streams for these businesses, because they are businesses at the end of the day, but people just, you know, they don't want to pay for it.
No, you know, the poll showed that right now about 19% of respondents in the Chicago area said they're paying for local news, but it said that a little more than half said that no one should pay for local news. Now the issue there is that reader revenue or digital subscriptions or memberships are increasingly the primary source of revenue for local news organizations. So if people are saying, look, we're not going to pay for this, that really creates an even bigger business model problem for local news organizations. And look, you know, as disappointing as that number was, 51%, that's actually better than some other surveys I've seen over the past 5 years, which showed as many as 70% of people didn't think you should have to pay for local news. So the trend, I think, seems to be in the right direction. But here's the problem. You know, for many years and a couple of decades, the news industry conditioned people to thinking that news was free. You know, while you were paying for a print subscription, you could go to a website and maybe get the exact same information for free off a homepage. And so I think in some ways the industry is still, if you'll pardon the pun, paying for that decision that was made a number of years ago. And so now they're in this position where, you know, it's a very weak advertising market for news these days. The ad numbers have been tough, and there have been layoffs at news organizations all over the country in the past 6 months or so. It's a tough financial environment. And so at the very time that reader revenue is so critical to news organizations, the attitude is still, well, you know what? We don't think we should pay.
Hmm. So, Tim, we've really just scratched the surface here when it comes to this report. And everyone should go check it out online, localnewsinitiative.northwestern.edu. But where do we go from here? I know you spent a lot of time on this report, and there's a lot of information in here. So is it to help those who are elected officials, maybe guide them to some better policy, to correct some of the issues that you and I have been talking about? Or what do we do with this information now that we have it?
Well, you know, the purpose is multifold. We wanted policymakers to see what public attitudes are about local news. You know, we also wanted foundations and philanthropists to have a good understanding of where the needs are and a better understanding of kind of the financial situation of local news. But we also wanted local news leaders in Chicago and journalists to be able to have a really clear understanding of the trends that are happening in local news right now so that they can react. You know, are we creating and editing and producing information tailored towards smartphones, which is now taken over as the predominant source of local news? You know, how do we get people to pay for local news? Are we delivering the kind of news that people say they want? I think those are all critical questions that I hope will help inform the news ecosystem here in Chicago.
This has really, I think, given us a lot to think about, a lot to talk about, Tim. And I know that you will continue your analysis and all of your work over at the Medill Local News Initiative. And if we want to check out this report online, we will link up to it through our channels. And we should check out localnewsinitiative.northwestern.edu. Tim Franklin is the director of the Medill Local News Initiative at Northwestern. Tim, I really always appreciate the time. It's always great to talk about this business that is really, I'll say it again, it really is important for our democracy. And we'll keep preaching that. So thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks for your interest, Mike.
That since the beginning of the 2023-24 school year, Illinois public schools are required to provide plant-based lunch options if requested by students in advance. Our state is the first in the nation to pass such a law. Audrey Lawson Sanchez is the founder of Balanced, that is a nutrition security and public health advocacy organization. And she is working to bring about awareness when it comes to this issue of providing plant-based lunch options in Illinois public schools. We could check out the website moreplantsonplatesil.com. Audrey Lawson Sanchez, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So let's start here by talking about this issue of providing this plant-based lunch option for students. What is the significance of the issue here? What are we talking about?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So as you noted, Illinois is the first state in the country to enact a law like this. And the significance is actually very exciting for the students and families in Illinois. It's really about one, meeting the needs and requests of these families and students and making sure that they have foods that align with their dietary needs or preferences. It's also about expanding lunch options for all students in Illinois. This is an opportunity to get new and exciting or newer versions of known loved food lunch options on menus for kids with a plant-based twist. And there are lots of implications for health, the environment, any number of reasons folks would want to have plant-based meals.
You know, I was looking at the menu, the sample menu here, and you're right. I think sometimes when we hear plant-based or vegan options, it's like, oh, well, it's going to taste so bad. That's not necessarily the case, right? I mean, you've got all kinds of like black bean salads on there, burgers, you know, obviously no meat, but it looks like it. I've had some versions of these dishes and they're good.
Yes, the plant-based foods of the today are not the plant-based foods of the 1970s, where folks think it's just, you know, dry salad with a side of rice or some raw vegetables. So many plant-based meals that are being served in schools are really, really delicious, and they can be like global cuisine. We're talking about things like chickpea marsala or, you know, build your own ramen bowls. So it could have like a plant-based twist, could, you know, and then there's also like plant-based chicken nuggets, and those are on some menus as well.
Right, right. So, you know, when we think about what was done here in Illinois with this law in 2023, so we haven't had it too long here in the state, but in terms of how this works, so families can opt in. This is not required. This is something if you want to opt in, is it really us going to the website and signing up for it?
Yes. I think this is like the genius of this law, right? Because it is not an initiative that forces people to eat plant-based if they're averse or have some reason that they wouldn't be interested, although we would encourage everyone to try it. But this law allows families to opt in. Yes, you can go to moreplantsonplatesil.com. There's a very fast, like 90-second form that you fill out. And based on the school district, that form gets sent directly to the nutrition director in that district. It allows families and students and teenagers, high schoolers can actually opt in themselves to pick the number of days a week they would like to have the plant-based meal. So even if a family or a student is not fully vegan or fully plant-based, but they are trying to eat more plants or trying to eat more plant-based, they could maybe pick one or two days a week and try it out there.
So it really is easy. I went to the Google form. I mean, it's basically like this Google form. It looks great. It's super simple. And you go to moreplantsonplatesil.com, and the big drop-down menu of all of these Illinois school districts, you can sign up. And if you want to opt in, it's not a full-time thing. You could get occasional options of plant-based food. And it's really that simple. So I do like the ease that we have here when it comes to signing up for this. And I'm curious, what have you heard in terms of feedback? So we've gone through the school year, we're wrapping it up here, but what's the feedback been so far?
Yeah, great question. And one note on that form is that it's available in multiple languages. So we're trying to make sure that anybody who wants to make this request, we're super inclusive of that. So thank you for noting how simple it is. We absolutely want to streamline that for everyone. But in terms of feedback, it has been overwhelmingly positive. So our collaborative, the More Plants on Plates collaborative, has been working not just on informing parents and students about this initiative, but also working directly with food service directors in different school districts across Illinois to help build their skill, right? Plant-based foods and preparing them for large groups of students can be new to a lot of folks. And so we have a number of pilot sites where we have helped them build out their menu, expand their menu to include plant-based options, and overwhelmingly positive. Not only are the schools that we've worked with going to continue offering to the students who make the request, but they are expanding it to more students, removing even more barriers, and just making these delicious meals available across the state.
I'm wondering here, and I have to ask this question because I remember when this was during the Obama administration, and I'm really not trying to put politics in this, but I remember the Michelle Obama, the healthy eating stuff, and there was so much pushback when she was doing her thing with the attempt to have healthy options for kids in school. And, you know, I was thinking, like, why are we fighting that? You know, shouldn't that be a thing that we can all agree on? We want our kids to eat good stuff. So was there any pushback for you when you were, I know you're raising awareness about this, but in terms of how the law was developed or just this in general, is there any pushback like, hey, it's the freedom that our kids get to eat crappy food if they want, or I don't know, but is that a thing?
So much less than you would think. And I think it's the way that the law was built, because it is designed to make these meals available to the students who want them. And it's not saying every student has to have them. And there's a lot of effort that the school districts and the food and nutrition departments are putting in to make sure that the foods are delicious and accommodating to students across cultures. I think because it is not, this is a mandate that requires every student uniformly to have this specific meal, there's been a lot less pushback. And I do think that there's a lot of enthusiasm for meeting the needs of all the students across the state.
Yeah, it's an option. And that's what we're emphasizing here. Right, sure. So you get the choice if you want it. And the website is moreplantsonplatesil.com. Moreplantsonplatesil.com. If you have a kid in school in Illinois, in public schools, and you want the option for your child to, or your children, I should say, because it's not just limited to one kid. You could have a few kids, right, with the plant-based options.
Yep. And as these requests come in, we are aware of which school districts the requests are going into. And so our team is also making sure that on not just the demand side, the students and families making this request, but the supply side, that they have all the tools and supports and resources they need so that it is a meal that is really robust and not something that people would say, oh, I don't want that plant-based option. It is all the meals. The teams are working really hard to make sure that they're really delicious and diverse and exciting.
This is exciting. I think this is really cool and important, and especially because we look at some of the health challenges that younger people are facing when we think about childhood obesity and just the ease with which people can get foods that are just not great for them and how they can consume them so quickly. This, I think, is really important to think about. And again, give the option for families. Again, the website is moreplantsonplatesil.com. Audrey Lawson Sanchez is the founder of Balanced. That's a nutrition security and public health advocacy organization. She is working hard on this option to provide plant-based lunch for students if they request it in Illinois public schools. Hey, Audrey, congrats on all of your hard work. I know it continues, and hopefully you get a bunch more people signing up.
Yeah, thank you so much for your support and for getting the word out. We're really excited.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader, online chicagoreader.com. And, man, Steve, you know I like this stuff. I have a soft spot. It's a just huge soft spot for Southern rock in general. And when it comes out of Chicago, which I feel like we can't always say happens, the Pearl Handle Band, they rock.
You know I'm with you 100% here, bro. You know I love me some almonds, some Hatchet.
Yeah.
Some ZZ Top, some Skynyrd. You know, to me, that's just good rock and roll, Southern or not, you know, however you want to slice it. And that, yeah, we have a band, had a band here in Chicago who were right there. Look-wise, sound-wise, chop-wise, with all those bands, it kind of blew my mind, and I was like, basically, hell yeah.
Yes. I mean, this is a deep cut when we're talking about the Pearl Handle Band. I know all of the bands you do are pretty much deep cuts, but this one especially, they put out an album in 1980. I mean, I had no idea this band even existed. But there's, of course,
sort of put out an album.
Right.
Sort of. Well, we'll get into that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But the sort of intersections that the members of the band have with other musicians that probably most of us have heard of is, you know, it's one of those stories. So, okay, let's talk about the origins of the Pearl Handle Band. And I mean, some of these guys are coming, they're coming from all over the place, but no one except one guy is actually from the South. Tell us some of the origins here of this band.
Yeah, I mean, these are some Illinois boys for sure, and some, you know, three-fourths of them from the Chicagoland area. And yeah, like you're saying, it ticks all the boxes for me here. Relations to other bands I love, you know, a little local history, and it had everything. Like when I did the interview with Mickey of the band, one of the guitar players, you know, when I first saw it come back, I was just like, This is amazing. This is too good to be true for what I am looking for. And all right, we'll get it out of the way first. The drummer, Mitch Aliotta. A lot of your listeners will probably know the Aliotta name from Aliotta, Haynes, and Jeremiah, who had the huge hit Lakeshore Drive.
That's right.
Which we all love and hold dear. Or if not, I'm going to come find you and hurt you.
You must love that song.
If you don't, just get out of the city. Just you they're gonna run you. If you don't like that and the Blues Brothers, they're gonna run you out of town on a rail.
Right.
You know, let's just you don't belong here. Anyways, that was his brother in that band. He had two sort of famous rocking brothers. They were actually both in Rotary Connection at one point with Minnie Riperton, which a lot of people don't know. So that's a sort of, you know, there's a lineage there, and they hail from Berwyn.
There it is.
As we know well, and so they are definitely local boys. And yeah, the bassist Mickey and guitarist Dan went to Lane Tech right here in Chicago. And then, yes, even the singer Big G George, he largely grew up in Waterman, Illinois, which I got to admit, I don't have a real good handle on exactly where. I think kind of near Fox Valley, it sounds like.
Yeah, maybe. 60 miles west of Chicago.
Yeah, I got to say, don't remember seeing that name. Lived here my whole life. Hear new neighborhoods of Chicago and towns in Illinois I've never heard of like once a month. Do you find this?
Especially like, with the rest of Illinois, I'm like, oh, there's a Waterman? All right.
Am I ignorant? Like, how did I miss that living here my entire life? But here we go, you know? So, yeah, so their origins are definitely here and sort of found their way, you know, into Southern rock. And, you know, you see a set list at the time and, you know, they're doing like Rolling Stones and Savoy Brown's bands that sort of went back a ways. But yeah, ZZ Top, Johnny Winter and stuff like that. They were kind of right there in the thick of things in the mid 70s.
About in terms of, you know, the recordings here, because we said that there's a story behind this, and you know, when 1980 happens, they're putting together this album. Tell us about how this all goes down.
Oh man, you know, it seems like playing live, that's what really went well for them. They opened for like great bands, from like arena rock bands like Van Halen to deeper cut southern rock bands like Black Oak Arkansas. They even played for like crazy heavy psychedelic bands like Captain Beyond and Mahogany Rush, you know, so they're really versatile. So I think getting that into a studio, you know, and open for just country guys like Waylon Jennings, you know, and Johnny Paycheck and stuff like that. So, you know, they sort of brought all that to the table, and they got a connection at, you know, this small label, Sunbird Records, who, you know, they were really popular locally. They were touring. They're opening for all these great bands. They did a tour of Texas. You know, they were getting around. So, yeah, it was a natural thing for them. But It just basically, it's the classic, like, the studio slash label and everything goes out of biz. They didn't even basically get to finish overdubbing on the record, you know, which is pretty standard with a band like this. Even though they had dual lead guitars, they're probably going to throw a couple more in there. You know,
of course.
You might want a couple more gritty raw vocals in there. So they didn't even get to do that. Basically, you know, they left the studio thinking they're going to come back and finish this. Well, no. They're not. They're not going to finish it. It's done. They didn't think about the recordings for years. You know, it was just sort of like one of these things that just sort of, you know, didn't happen. I got some tapes like that myself, to be honest. And there, and then all of a sudden, in the early 80s, a friend of theirs, he's digging in a store in Nashville in the cassette bargain bin, and there's a Pearl Handle tape. Pearl Handle Band tape.
Okay, so they thought that they didn't finish it. They didn't finish the overdubs, and they couldn't finish the final mixes as well. And they thought, all right, whatever. And some years go by, they think the thing doesn't come out, but someone finds it, this tape, in a record store.
You know, we'll call it shelved. We'll call it a shelved album. I think that was, you know, official term. And then, yeah, and you know, they can't even exactly figure out how it happened. A lot of times when labels and studios go bust, and this is another thing I've encountered when contacting old musicians and trying to get hold of their old recordings and such, is sometimes a label, when they're going bust, they just sell everything that they did in a lot. They're like, here's the tapes, here's everything, just take it, you know? And some of it's finished stuff, some of it's half-finished stuff. When you think of the gold that was probably in that stuff and then ended up in a landfill and or recorded over just to use the expensive tape, you know, it I don't want to think about it because it hurts someone like me. But a lot of, you know, but a lot of labels would do that. And that's the theory, is that they just sold off everything. So this Brylin label heard it and was like, hey, it's probably pretty good Southern rock here. Let's not try to contact the guys. We'll just throw it on a tape and put it out. You know, like what? Assuming a pretty minuscule quantity. So then, of course, you know, people who are fans of any kind of music are obsessive like myself. And it ended up online, you know, this sort of thing. So it's had a weird life, this, let's call it a bootleg. We'll call it a bootleg is basically what it is.
Yeah. And boy, a crazy story about that album. I mean, it sounds good, but the guys in the Pearl Handle Band who we're talking about here, they pretty much burn themselves out because they're playing all the time, they're touring constantly, and so they break up, and this music lives on. They kind of all go their separate ways to a degree.
Yeah, Big G continued on in bands. Sometimes Mickey jams with Dan, and Mickey still has bands that play to this day. But yeah, you know, they had all sort of moved on, and then I believe it was George got holds of the master tape, and that was actually 12 songs. 7 somehow ended up on the bootleg. So got hold of it, and then through a weird other kind of Chicago connection, the store Permanent Records that used to be here, they were actually came here from St. Louis, had success in Chicago as a store, and then went out to LA and opened like 3 stores. But super nice kids. They love obscure old music, and they were stocking a single by an old band of George's, basically, and sort of, you know, made the connection to the Pearl Handle Band, to make a long story short. And then Lance of Permanent Records, super great guy, played it for this Riding Easy label out on the West Coast, and boom, we are finally going to have a legitimate LP release of this, yeah, killer shredding Southern rock.
Awesome. And that could come out in January of next year?
Yeah, the label's got a really full schedule, so it wouldn't, but at the very least, you can go to their Bandcamp, the Riding Easy Bandcamp page, and you can hear the whole album. That's where I was able to finally hear those extra five tracks and all this stuff. And it sounds great. I'm not a big streamer, but I do endorse Bandcamp and a few other platforms, and it's a great way to hear it for now. But also, as an obsessive, I want this baby in my hands. I want to be able to drop the needle on this thing after so many years. And I'm just an obsessive and like some rock and roll.
That's right. And we've got the rock and roll this week. The Pearl Handle Band, awesome, from Chicagoland. Check out that album coming out next year. Oh my goodness, that's going to be phenomenal. And we could check out ChicagoReader.com for the full story of the Pearl Handle Band. Some local music that maybe you never heard of, but you should. Just, as we say, shredding Southern rock. Steve Krakow is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in The Reader. He's also an artist, musician, music historian himself. And you drew the picture of these guys? Just cowboy hats, lots of hair, lots of facial hair, everything you'd ever want in a Southern rock band. Steve, I applaud you, sir.
I have to say, drawing a cool looking band with some good stashes, that is another box checked off for me right there. I'll send you my official checklist of, you know, enjoyment for Secret History that I get, but that is a big one.
And that does it. Outside the Loop show number 921 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering skills in the WGN radio studio today. I hope you have a fantastic week. Hey, come on back next time. I'll be here. It'll be great. Here on Outside the Loop.